And many exhibitions that take place here are really his creation, including, for example, several years ago, Visual Music. He has been concentrating on this exhibition for many, many years, and he'll probably tell you something about it. But it has always been his dream to do Yves Klein exhibition, and indeed it is here. It's the first exhibition of Yves Klein in the United States after 30 years. The other person that I have with me is Belmont Freeman, right here. Belmont Freeman is an established architect who lives in New York. In 1986, he found Freeman and Pizzer Architects, and in 1994, he created his own architecture firm called Belmont Freeman Architects. An extraordinary creative group, he's also an academic, so he also lectures. He received numerous prizes for his architecture, so we are extremely grateful for him to be here. What is known, why we have chosen Belmont Freeman is because he was a chairman of the Storefront Gallery in New York, a non-for-profit, where they put together a wonderful architectural exhibition of Yves Klein architecture. And this is the particular element during this event that he will concentrate on and speak about. Richard Chartier, right here next to him, is a Washington, D.C.-based sound artist who actually performs internationally. He has been in Europe, Japan, Australia, North America. In many of these venues, he has produced something that is known as microsound or neo-modernist sound, which means absolutely minimal music architecture, music performance. He has performed here before. He has also been included, for example, in 2008 Whitney Biennale. The next person next to Kerry is really extremely famous, unbelievably active, Roland Celeste. Roland is a culture attaché at the French embassy, but he's, I have to tell you, much more than that. He's probably one of the most active culture attaché of any embassy. He's an avid reader, loves theater, loves music, has organized all kinds of concerts, not only in the French embassy, but also in other museums such as the National Gallery or the Phillips Collection. And we love having Roland with us. We will start talking now and expect to finish our walkthrough at 7:30. At 7:30, we will move to the third floor. We are on the second floor. In the middle of the third floor, there is a learner room. And in the learner room, we will be experiencing something really, something exciting, something that we haven't done at the Hirschhorn before. And that's a judo performance. That is being, and the person who is in charge of the group that you will be seeing from 7:30 to 8 is Ted Knowles. He is the 6-degree black belt and judo instructor with the Washington Judo Club. He's right there, he's doing the walkthrough with us. He has done judo demonstrations all over Washington, including White House, the Japanese Embassy, the National Cherry Blossom Festival. They will concentrate during their demonstration to talk to you about what it means to register with Kodagan. And Kodagan is the type of judo that Yves Klein was passionate about. Thank you. Kerry.
Thanks, Melina. Well, I, you know, I'm really happy that there's such a big group here tonight. Thank you all for coming, and we hope to do something quite different tonight. On the other hand, I wish it wasn't such a big group because I wanted to stop in the first gallery to begin with to talk about a few things in that very first gallery, which hopefully as you walk through I can speak about now, which I think kind of sets the stage for Yves Klein. Now, we're going to do something very, very different tonight. There are four of us that are going to try to do a kind of moving panel discussion, because I'm really tired of panel discussions that just sit on the stage and they don't go anywhere. So we're actually going to move it through the show, and we're going to try to each offer our own insights into Yves Klein from very, very different perspectives, from perspective of a curator, from the perspective of a composer and designer, and from the perspective of an architect and the perspective of a cultural attaché, as well as the head of a judo school, the judo expert, which Klein was very involved with. So you're going to hear all those different sides tonight, and this is why we call it the Many Faces of Eve. We should have called this the Three Faces of Eve. But there's more than just three, so we had to settle for this. But anyway, the very first gallery that you walked into sets the stage for Eve Klein, I think, in an unusual way. Most people know Eve Klein, if you know him at all, from his blue monochromes that he did, as the famous, French artist who made famous the blue monochrome. Or if you don't know the blue monochrome, usually people know the anthropometries, in which he had nude models come out with blue paint on their bodies and kind of conducted them to create impressions on canvases, which became these wonderful paintings. But everything that's behind Klein's work, pretty much everything he did throughout his entire life, and by the way, his life was very, very short. He died when he was 34 years old, and he really didn't start making the art that you see in this exhibition until 1955. He died in 1962, which means that his entire career as an artist was no more than 7 years, really, which is about the same amount of time it took us to put this exhibition together. So I can't even imagine how an artist does this. But in the very first gallery, the first thing you see is not a monochrome painting, not an anthropometry painting. The first thing you see is a film, and it's an image of Eve Klein pointing to a blank wall. And he's contemplating this wall, and he seems to be gesturing toward it. And he seems to be wondering, is there something supposed to be on this wall? Do you have to hang a painting on the wall? Or can you not hang a painting on the wall, and yet it's still about something? And for Klein, his desire was for everyone to reach a state of immaterial sensibility. That's what he kept repeating over and over again. The immaterial, to reach a state of immaterial sensibility, to go into, as he called it sometimes, the void. Now, the other film that you saw as you came in, by that wall of color monochromes, were some images that had been shot, that Klein had shot himself. It's very clear he had it kind of set up. At the Aries Claire Gallery in 1958, at an exhibition which has become known as The Void. And in that exhibition, on the outside of the gallery, he painted, and I'll talk more about blue later, but he painted the windows blue, and he had a blue curtain hung. You entered through the blue curtain just like you would be staring at this painting, this blue painting. But you entered it, and you came out on the other side, and on the other side was nothing, just an empty room, which he had earlier taken all the paintings out of and then whitewashed everything in the room and then left again. So that was the void. And one of the things that he wanted to do with what he called International Klein Blue, which was not so much a color he invented, because the color is just ultramarine, but what he invented was the way of applying the color to a surface without having to mix it up with a binder first and then paint it on with a brush. He was always looking for a way of making a painting without actually making a painting. And as we go through the show, you'll see that everything he did was a way of both embracing painting and also getting away from painting. Because for him, what he would say is, painting was not the end product. This behind me here, as beautiful as it is to me anyway, was not the final thing that he was about. In fact, what he called it was the ashes of his art. It was only the ashes left over after he'd been thinking about the void. And it was only a gateway into the void. It was only a way of a portal of contemplation of getting to the immaterial sensibility. So I'd like to stop there for a moment, and maybe I could actually ask Roland and
Audrey.
Sorry.
Audrey.
Audrey, if they could maybe say a few words about this, and actually what Roland would like to do is actually, instead of a little bit like what we did with the show, actually. If you go through this exhibition, you're not going to find any curatorial interpretation through the show. If you want curatorial interpretation, buy the book, which is this pure blue object, or read the brochure. But if you want Klein's own words, that's what we used in the exhibition. Everything in the exhibition is Klein's own words when you see a text. What Roland's going to do is read you poetry, I think from approximately the late 1800s to the 1950s or so. Yes. So
thank you, Gary. It's a little bit difficult to talk about literature and Yves Klein because you can talk about the books he has read and you can talk about the books at the same time, written at the same time that he was painting, because some of them have the same kind of inspiration, even he has not read those books. So I will try to do both of them. And I just would like to try to start with a poem by Baudelaire, because of course Yves Klein was a great reader of Baudelaire and Rimbaud, and just to set the tone. And the poem by Baudelaire maybe is known by you, it's Correspondance, which establishes the link between this immaterial sensitivity and the material world. And nature is considered as a temple where some hints are given to you. And you will see that the first part of the poem is a kind of theory, and the second half of the poem is an example of this kind of correspondence between sound and color, between color and the sense of touch. And you will just see how he moves from the theory to the actual example. Maybe we'll read it, because we don't have enough text, maybe we'll read it in English first and in French after.
Correspondences. Nature is a temple in which living pillars sometimes give voice to confused words. Man passes there through forests of symbols which look at him with understanding eyes. Like prolonged echoes mingling in the distance in a deep, tenebrous unity. Vast as the dark of night and as the light of day, perfumes, sounds, and colors correspond. There are perfumes as cool as the flesh of children, sweet as oboes, green as meadows, and others are corrupt and rich, triumphant, with power to expand into infinity like amber and essence, musk, benzoin, that sing the ecstasy of the soul and senses.
And in French, correspondance. La nature est un temple où de vivants piliers laissent parfois sortir de confuses paroles. L'homme y passe à travers des forêts de symboles qu'il observe avec des regards familiers, comme de longs échos qui de loin se confondent dans une ténébreuse et profonde unité, vaste comme la nuit et comme la clarté, les parfums, les couleurs et les sons se répondent. Il est des parfums frais comme des chairs d'enfants, doux comme les hautbois, verts comme les prairies, et d'autres corrompus, riches et triomphants, ayant l'expansion des choses infinies, comme l'ambre, le musc, le benjoin et l'encens qui chantent les transports de l'esprit et des sens. Maybe you don't understand all the French words, but some are same as in English. And we would like to read another text by Rimbaud. Rimbaud had a strong influence, I think, on Yves Klein. And there are very famous text by Rimbaud, especially one giving the color of vowels, the Wild's sonnet. But I decided to choose the bridges because it's very abstract painting, in fact, and with the gray color and just a little bit a touch of red and blue. And we'll read it in English and then in French.
The bridges, gray skies of crystal, a a bizarre design of bridges, now straight, now curved, and others descending in oblique angles to meet the former, and these patterns repeating themselves in other well-lit windings of a canal, but also long and weightless that the shores, weighted with domes, sink and contract. Some of these bridges are still covered with hovels. Others bear masts, signals, frail parapets. Minor cords interlace and fade. Ropes rise from the banks. You distinguish a red coat, other clothes perhaps, and musical instruments. Are those popular airs, snatches from noble concerts, the remains of public anthems? The water is gray and blue, wide as an arm of the sea. A white ray, falling from on high, annihilates this comedy.
Les ponts. Des ciels gris de cristal. Un bizarre dessin de pont. Ceux-ci droits, ceux-là bombés, d'autres descendant ou obliquant en angle sur les premiers, et ces figures se renouvelant dans les autres circuits éclairés du canal, mais tous tellement longs et légers que les rives, chargées de dômes, s'abaissent et s'amoindrissent. Quelques-uns de ces ponts sont encore chargés de masures. D'autres soutiennent des mâts, des signaux, de frêles parapets. Des accords mineurs se croisent et filent. Des cordes montent des berges. On distingue une veste rouge, peut-être d'autres costumes et des instruments de musique. Sont-ce des airs populaires, des bouts de concerts seigneuriaux, des restants d'hymnes publics? L'eau est grise et bleue, large comme un bras de mer, un rayon blanc tombant du haut du ciel a néanti cette comédie.
I wanted to actually mention that one of the very first pieces that Eve Klein ever did was something called a monotone symphony, monotone silence. And the correspondence that you read by Baudelaire reminds me of the kind of concept of synesthesia and the idea that colors can relate to music. And this evening, Richard Chartier is going to talk about this very, very early work of Eve Klein's that he did, or at least that he conceived of in the late 1940s. We're going to move now to the next large room, which is, you'll recognize it because it's filled with what is called the anthropometries. Those are the ones in which women were painted blue and Klein pressed their bodies, again, or had them press their bodies against the canvases. So we'll stop there, and then Richard will talk a little bit about the Monotone Symphony.
Good evening. Can everyone hear me? Okay. My name is Richard Chartier. I'm a sound artist. And what really fascinated me about Eve Klein is this work that he did, which was the only work he did with sound or music. And if you look back here right now, when the video starts, which it's not starting, you'll see that on March 9th in 1960, he did a performance which these paintings were made, and you'll see him make them, and there's a collection of nine musicians, and he's conducting them as well as conducting the women that are being painted and then pressed on the canvases. Now, what you don't realize when you're watching this is that the Monotone Silent Symphony went as follows. It was very specific. It was 20 minutes of a single note, F sharp, 20 minutes, these nine musicians, and then 20 minutes of complete silence. So what he's doing here is very, very different from anything else that was going on at the time. It predates, he said he made this in between 1947 and 1949, which when he originally composed this work. Now that's several years before John Cage did his piece, 4 minutes and 33 seconds, which was a piece that was complete silence. So this predates minimalism in music as well, because it wasn't until 1968 that Michael Nyman coined the term minimum music, or minimalism as a genre. One of the things that he said about this is that even in its presence, this symphony does not exist. It exists outside the phenomenology of time, because it is neither born nor will it die. So what he's creating here is almost less of a musical piece and more of a sculpture, because everyone that's listening to this is involved in this piece when it's performed as such. So it's kind of enigmatic. It's almost a meditation in a way. And it goes along with a lot of his other ideas of the void. You have this pure tone that's being played by these musicians, and then you have the void. It's very much like how the paintings, one of his early exhibits of the monochromes, were presented distance away from the wall to present the void as something not part of this world. So here you have Eve Klein creating this work, and he felt that the duration wasn't actually important, and that it had a feeling outside of time. So what he wanted you to do is basically, it's almost like a drone work, and you kind of lose your sense of time within this space. I'm trying to think, there's the after silence. What really interests me about this work is the after silence, is there's a physicality to it, because he's taking people and placing them in this situation where they're hearing something than hearing nothing, which is very, very different from most. You know, you have music and you have spaces between the music, but to extend this into the void was quite different. And it really relates to a piece that he did in 1946, was called The Signing of the Sky, in which he had his signature, had a little airplane go up and basically sign the sky, and it dissolved. So that was a very early work by him. And then you have this work. It's kind of the same thing, where it's the material and then the immaterial, and these two things colliding. One of the last things he said after, when the performance was over, he just said, "The myth is in the art." So that's.
Thanks, Richard. I wanted to just say a couple of things about these paintings, and because they're somewhat different, and also the sponge reliefs that you saw and the sponge sculptures that you saw as you came by. Klein had been working with the monochromes for some time. When he realized, and what he was trying to do was get you to contemplate this void, and he felt that ultramarine was this deep blue color, which was the further than nothingness, in a way. He often quotes Gaston Bachelard, a French philosopher, that says, first there's nothing, then there's a deep nothing, and then there's deep blue after that. And so Klein was trying to get you to contemplate that. But what he found was he would often use sponges as he would paint. And he was realizing that what he felt personally was that it was sucking up the blue, the sponge. And so he got very interested in the idea that the sort of immaterial was finding its way into this material sponge. So he began to add the sponges to the paintings as a kind of notion of moving between the two worlds of the immaterial and the material world, the sponge being material but having sucked up the color of the immaterial sensibility. These paintings behind me, such as this one called When People Begin to Fly, which is from the Manil Collection in Houston, were made because he started thinking a lot about, he thought a lot about Hiroshima, for example, and the way that people, and actually this painting on the left over here is actually titled Hiroshima. And he thought about Hiroshima and how, despite the fact that people were incinerated and no longer existed, that they would find this strange
shadow that was left of them on the wall after they were completely gone. And to him, it was a mark of the immaterial that had been left, a mark that there is the immaterial, that there was something there, but it was no longer there. So he got the idea of creating these, what he called anthropometries, in which he would put color onto a person's body, including his own, such as in the piece we own at the Hirshhorn over here. And this was his model, Rotrot, who later became his wife. And then having them press their body against the painting, against the surface, and then pulling away. So instead of painting an individual and trying to recreate someone as a fiction, instead it was what was left of them after they had disappeared. First they were there, then they were gone, and this is what's left. And we'll find this also when we reach the fire paintings later. And Belmont will talk at that point about the architecture then. Roland would like to read a piece by Michaud now to go with the anthropometries.
Yes, we have two small texts by Michaud. Maybe we'll read the first one, Council on the Subject of Pines. I have only the English translation. I couldn't find the French text here in DC today. So we'll read it in English.
Council on the Subject of Pines. A monotonous noise does not necessarily calm. The drill calms no one, except perhaps the driller. Nevertheless, it is a monotonous sound that one has the greatest chance in finding calm. What is agreeable in the sound of wind blowing through a forest of pine is that this sound has no edge, it is round. But there is nothing of the gloomy. Or does it calm by inducing us to imagine an eminent and debonair being unable to definitely unhinge itself? However, one must not look too much to the top of the pines being blown by strong wind. For if one begins to imagine oneself seated on their apex, in such a balancing act, one could, and even more naturally than if one were to find oneself on a swing or in an elevator, due to the strange and superb movement up there, feel oneself carried away, and, although forcing oneself not to think about it, certainly far from wanting to meditate on this balancing, one is ceaselessly occupied with it. One feels oneself always in the vacillating top of a pine. One can no longer return to earth.
And the other text is from a book which is The Great Ordeals of the Mind. And the first paragraph is Désorientation. And in this text, Michaud is exploring with a drug, the mescaline, and he is trying to find what each moment is made of. And his idea is that one moment, even we are not aware of that, is made of an infinity of moments. And that's what is called the marvelous. And the text is very interesting.
I want to lift the veil from the normal, the unrecognized, unsuspected, incredible, enormous normal. The abnormal first acquainted me with it, disclosing to me the prodigious number of operations which the most ordinary of men performs, casually, unconcerned, as routine as work, interested only in the outcome and not in the mechanisms, however marvelous, far more wonderful than the ideas he sets such store by, which are often so commonplace, mediocre, unworthy of the matchless instrument that reveals and plies them. I want to lift the veil from the complex mechanisms which make man, first and foremost, an operator.
And I read the text in French, if you want. Désorientation. Merci. Je voudrais dévoiler le normal. Unveil the normal. Je voudrais dévoiler le normal, le méconnu, l'insoupçonné, l'incroyable, l'énorme normal. La normale me l'a fait connaître. Ce qui se passe, le nombre prodigieux d'opérations even in English, you can understand, le nombre prodigieux d'opérations que dans l'heure la plus détendue, le plus ordinaire des hommes accomplit, ne s'en doutant guère, n'y prêtant attention aucune, travail de routine, dont le rendement seul l'intéresse et non ses mécanismes pourtant merveilleux, bien plus que ses idées, à quoi il tient tant, si médiocres souvent, communes, indignes de l'appareil hors ligne qui les découvre et les manie, je voudrais dévoiler les mécanismes complexes qui font de l'homme avant tout un opérateur. And the entire book by Michaud is to unveil these numberless mechanisms that work in your mind in each microsecond. And so just to see how it works.
Rohan, thank you. I hate having to come back out here and talk after he speaks. It just doesn't sound the same. I just want to say one word before we move on. And I just want you to notice, when we were in the very first gallery, one of the first images that you see in the show is a sort of seminal work by Yves Klein. It's almost become his logo in a kind of sense. It's called The Leap into the Void, which he used on the cover of a fake newspaper that he did called Dimanche, based on a real newspaper in France at the time. And this photograph is of him leaping off the second story of a building, and it's The Leap into the Void. And we won't talk about how he did it. Perhaps he actually did leap into the void that day. But I mention it to you only to think about something, and that it reoccurs in Klein's work all the time, and that is the concept of flying and the idea of levitation. And behind me, you see people begin to fly. You see people descending in a work over there, which is actually rather based on Duchamp's new Descending a Staircase. And as we talk about some of the architectural ideas, we're also going to be talking about levitation. When we get Tad Knowles, we'll talk later about judo and many, I think, of his ideas, of Klein's ideas about levitation and flying. Some of them came from Zen, some of them came from meditation, but a lot came from judo, I think. Belmont, did you have anything you wanted to add at this point about architecture? Okay. We're going to be moving on now to the next largest room, a couple rooms from here, which will be the room of the fire paintings, the ones that he did near the end of his life. You're now in the room that we have the fire paintings in. These were some of the last works that Klein actually did. And towards the end of his life, he started thinking more and more about fire as really being at the heart of everything that he did. In fact, the colors that he chose to use, he ultimately realized that blue and also gold, we passed through the monogold room that was right before this, in which he used gold leaf to make paintings. And pink, you notice a lot of pink monochromes here and there, even at the very beginning of his career, that all of those colors, the rose, the gold, and the blue, all come out of fire, in a way. So this idea of destruction, that one could destroy, but through that destruction, make something new, create something, is also at the heart of Klein's thinking. Now, he created these works, actually most of them were created at a place called, it was actually a gas works outside of Paris, in which he, and you can see him working right there, using this incredibly large blowtorch, and he's working on the canvas. Right before this, he had a couple women step up, he put water on them, they had stepped away, and then he's got what appears to be a fireman there dousing this with water so it won't burn up. In fact, it's just a friend he put a fireman's hat on. So I think Klein is one of the first artists that I'm aware of who really, in a funny way, kind of knew how to use the media.
these ideas of the performances of the anthropometry in 1958, in which he invited, you know, an audience to come to dressed to the hilt, the way he would appear often in, he was a member of the Knights of the Order of Saint Sebastian, and he would appear in full regalia of Saint Sebastian at times. When he got married, he was dressed completely in that outfit. The idea of making a newspaper and distributing it around town seems to be a kind of media platform. But I should say that actually it was the beginnings of artists' use of media, and he didn't quite know how to use it yet because he really got bitten by it as well. He agreed to participate in a film called Mondo Cani that some of you might be familiar with from the early 1960s. And in Mondo Cani, he was approached by the director, and he thought it was a legitimate film, that the director wanted to actually make a film about what Klein did in a serious manner. As it turned out, Mondo Cani, not an uninteresting film, but Mondo Cani, a film which was about the bizarre, the weird, the unusual. And so he was portrayed, strangely, as a Czechoslovakian artist in Mondo Cani as this bizarre figure. And he saw the premiere at the Cannes Film Festival in 1962, and he was really hurt deeply by it, and that evening he suffered his first heart attack. So we could say that he knew how to use the media, but the media also struck back, and he got caught up in it and didn't quite know how to use it completely. Anyway, what we'd like to talk about in this room, because most of what we're going to be referring to, or what Belmont's going to be referring to, is work that is in the next couple of rooms, but it's much too small for this group to get into. And actually, fire is at the core of much of what Belmont's going to speak about in terms of air architecture, which Klein was getting very much interested in the late 50s and the early 1960s.
Thanks, Gary. I think that Klein's experiments with fire are a good segue into his architecture, because we usually think of fire relative to building as a destructive force, but in fact, Klein was viewing fire as a building material along with water and air. And in Klein's famous lecture at the Sorbonne in 1959, he stated that he considered his air architecture really to be the pinnacle, the apex of his artistic investigations, not just because architecture, as we all know, is the mother of all arts, but also because it represented an elevation of his drive to dematerialize art. And that was the title of his lecture at the Sorbonne, was The Evolution of Art Towards the Immaterial. His air architecture elevated this drive to remove physicality from his art to the environmental scale. It also was the best yet platform for his notions about the advancement of human society towards a new consciousness and utopian social condition. And by that, I'll quote, he explained that he was looking towards the advent of a new society destined to undergo deep transformations in its very condition. Intimacy, both personal and in the family, will disappear. An impersonal ontology will be developed. The willpower of man will at last regulate life on a constantly, quote, wonderful level. Man will be so free that he can even levitate, as Carrie pointed out in these earlier paintings, the paintings you just saw. The obstacles that traditional architecture used to put up with will be eliminated. Klein's project in air architecture was quite simply to design habitable microclimates that people could inhabit in new communities that would represent a new paradise. Air was to be used as the principal building material to encapsulate the space, fire and water to modify temperature, and the earth underneath these immaterial structures would contain all the functional necessities like mechanical spaces and bathrooms and storage rooms, so that people would be free to live on the ground plane in a new manner of living, unrestrained by conventional conventions of the physical world. By rejecting conventional architecture and construction, he would be taking us back to before the proverbial primitive hut, but actually back to a pre-architectural Garden of Eden. So in a sense, his air architecture was really the epitome of anti-architecture. Klein explained, "A great architectural project that has always been close to my heart is the realization of a dwelling that is really immaterial, but emotionally, technically, and functionally practical. This house must be built with the help of a new material, air, blown into walls, partitions, roof, and furniture. It must, of course, be possible to provide air conditioning so that the construction material itself can become the general and ambient heating and refrigeration of the whole house. All the foundations of this house will, at most, reach no higher than ground level. These foundations will be built of solid material. All the sheds, kitchens, bathroom, etc., can be locked up. It will be underground. As for the rest, it will not be necessary to provide any means of closing the house, for there will not be anything tangible to steal or take away." It's fascinating to me that Klein is sort of touching that while Klein's air architecture was clearly a utopian endeavor, he seemed to believe that his structures of air, fire, and water, with a bit of work, were technically feasible and could actually be built. Klein, for example, really got into, as you see in this film, he really got into the gadgetry of all the nozzles that would be used to shoot fire around, and he reportedly worried a lot about the noise that fans would make blowing air across his structures to form their roofs. His air architecture started to take a conceptual, graphic, and a physical form in his collaborations with the architect Werner Runau in 1958, when Runau selected Klein for the installation of his monumental monochromes at the theater in Gelsenkirchen. Runau, who was an avant-garde architect of considerable significance himself, collaborated with him on these early projects. For the Gelsenkirchen project, Klein and Runau designed his first fire fountains, which you'll see in some beautiful drawings in the next room. But they also designed an air cafe, which was to be adjacent to the theater with a roof of forced air to protect you from rain and cold, and walls of fire jets to keep you warm. And he was convinced that this was going to work, but the client was skeptical and balked at the cost not only of building this thing, but of powering it. So he sort of pulled the plug on the project, much to Runau's bitterness. But Klein marched along merrily and patented his invention of the air roof. I think about where these notions came from of being able to build a building of no materiality. Certainly his year in Japan, I think he came to appreciate Japanese minimalism and Zen sense of space. But also, even though, according to Runau and others, Klein wasn't particularly interested in contemporary architecture or knowledgeable about it, he and Runau did discuss the work of Mies van der Rohe, who had, by the late 50s, taken his architecture to an extreme of transparency in the Farnsworth House, for example, that had been built in 1951. Klein was ready to take Mises' dictum of less is more to its extreme expression, while the modern movement in architecture had been dedicated to eliminating superfluity, which Mies and Gropius and Adolf Loos took as eliminating ornament and unnecessary mass from their architecture. Klein would take it one step further and eliminate structure entirely. Klein also knew Philip Johnson, who had built his glass house in 1951, perfectly transparent house in which he too had buried all the mechanical stuff underground, you know, so nobody could see it. And Klein knew Johnson. They corresponded. There's some wonderful letters in a case down here. And Philip Johnson had purchased a couple of Klein's blue paintings. And then later, Klein accused Philip Johnson of stealing his idea for a fire and water fountain that Johnson had proposed for the 1964 World's Fair in New York. Philip denied it vehemently, saying, well, anybody could have thought that up. But I tend to suspect that Klein was right, since Philip Johnson was a shameless thief of the best ideas of all of his collaborators, including Mies van der Rohe and the glass house. Buckminster Fuller was also, I think, it was an influence here, because Fuller was at this time pushing his own highly technocratic drive towards eliminating materiality from architecture. It was 1961 when Fuller proposed his dome over Manhattan to control the climate, which was sort of very much akin to Klein's subsequent projects. But very much in the air in the 1950s was this notion that technology was going to answer all of our problems. The culmination of Klein's air architecture projects was the Cité Climatisée, in which he designed a whole city that was going to be protected by his air shelters. This was designed in conjunction, in collaboration with the architect Claude Parent, who was also very significant in the history of avant-garde architecture in the 60s and 70s. In the Cité Climatisée, there are some beautiful drawings in the next room that you'll see as we go through. The entire city is covered by an air roof. It's bisected by a highway that leads to the airport. One side of the city is industrial, the other side is residential. And the ground plane is glass, so that everybody feels like they're walking on air. And you can look down to see the mechanical guts of this city. There's a drawing in the next room that looks to me all the world like a diagram for a modern day geothermal heat plant. So in a sense, Klein was anticipating the next decade's concern about harnessing the forces of the earth in an ecological way, to work, control climate by working with it. And in this perfect climate, of course, nobody needed clothes, so we were going to be into a post-clothing era. Everybody would walk around naked, and since, you know, there were no material possessions to have, there was no need for security or privacy or even furniture. You can see in the drawings that he anticipated chairs and tables and beds that were made of air jets that come up and, you know, and support you. He was reportedly delighted by the invention in England at the time of a hospital bed of air jets designed for burn victims. And he said, see, it can work, you know, why not tables and everything else? And as Carrie said, that Klein was always interested in this whole notions of levitation. He, at the same time, was designing sculptures that levitated on sound waves, on electromagnetic fields, And it all became sort of a piece. So you can see, you know, leaping into the void, levitation. His drawings illustrate a blissful Eden, almost ecstatic, with these levitating figures floating on jets of air. One of them, I swear, is a ringer for Bernice St. Teresa. But at the same time, to me at least, they suggest a certain underlying anxiety that this whole, this new Eden that's based upon technology and harnessing of cosmic forces is in a very tenuous, unstable state. That, you know, if there were anything, you know, relying upon the force of the fans to keep your air roof functioning, relying upon the cooperation of geothermal forces, or, you know, a big hurricane not coming to knock out your fire walls, you know, all is lost, because there's no longer a cave to go run into to hide. You're really exposed there. And so I see in these drawings of Eden a certain, you know, anxiety of the incipient Cold War period.
Thanks, Belmont. That was great. I want to let Roland have the last word in this panel discussion. He's going to read some more material. And then when he is through, we're going to go upstairs to the next floor and to a room called the Learner Room, which you will all recognize. It's the room with the windows in it. And then Tad Knowles and his colleagues are going to be discussing a little bit about judo and demonstrating judo, and then maybe we can answer a few questions after that demonstration. So Roland.
Thank you, Gary. Just a few words. Because we see this theme of void, and you know that Yves Klein stayed in Japan several years at the beginning of his life. And I was in Japan many years, and it's quite difficult to understand this concept of void for Japanese. Maybe you know, and Yves Klein was reading also Zen texts, especially a famous Zen teacher was in Europe, Deshimaru Suzuki. And he was reading that book. So the idea, one very, very famous koan, you know the koans, there are small sentences which seem without meaning. One of the most famous in Japan is what is the sound of one hand clapping? And this is exactly a short sentence which can just lead you to the understanding of mu, of this void, because there is no way to explain it, no way to see it, there is only the way to experience it. And I know a Zen teacher, and he's saying that, for instance, in the Bible you have the same kind of koan. For instance, in the beginning was the world. You would think that in the beginning is a million years ago, 10 million years ago, 100 of million years ago, 1,000 of million years ago, and you will never find the answer. And the answer for him is in the saying of this word. Think at what it means. In the beginning was the word. You have said the beginning as soon as you said the word. You know, so this is a kind of word that you experience. And that is exactly the theme of that you cannot describe the void. You can only go through an experience of it. As with the koan system, you just have to experience a sentence. I don't know if I'm clear enough, but it just maybe a little bit about Japan. And I found a text by Jacques Dupin. It's not exactly the same kind of inspiration, but it's the same kind of meditation about the void, and it's finding the void inside yourself, and this being your center from where everything will then reappear. Maybe we'll read it in English first. It's a very short text, and you will see that at one moment he said, "The time knelt down." So it's something you will see in the text written by Yves Klein, the Phenomenology du Temps. And I think this text has something to do with this kind of concepts.
At instants, I thought I merged with a deeper reality like a river the sea, occupied a place, at least acceded to it with stealth, left an imprint on it, stole a firebrand from it, a place where the opacity of the world seemed to open into the rustle and mingle of word, light, and blood. I thought I crossed, alive and wide-eyed, the node where I was born, a gray and tolerable long-sufferingness, a smothering comfort were abolished at a blow and justified by the steady illumination of a few words that fitted against all hope. We collided outside of time, but time knelt down, and if I did not master it on its course, then at least I ordered its lightning eclipses, so I thought. The throbbing of the abyss punctuated like abuse the dew's offering to the sun outside on each barb.
So I will read it in French. J'ai cru rejoindre par instant une réalité plus profonde comme un fleuve, la mer, occuper un lieu, du moins y accéder de manière furtive, y laisser une empreinte, y voler un tison, un lieu où l'opacité du monde semblait s'ouvrir au ruissellement confondu de la parole, de la lumière et du sang. J'ai cru traverser vivant, les yeux ouverts, le nœud dont je naissais, une souffrance morne et tolérable, un confort étouffant se trouvait d'un coup aboli et justifié par l'illumination fixe de quelques mots inespérément accordés. Nous coïncidions hors du temps, mais le temps pliait les genoux, et si je ne le maîtrisais pas dans sa course, du moins commandais-je alors à ces fulgurantes éclipses, je l'ai cru, le battement de l'abîme scandait abusivement l'offrande de rosée au soleil dehors sur chaque ronce.